Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hi, welcome to Masonic Central. This is Greg Stewart and my co-host Dean Kennedy. This is the weekly podcast that's created for Freemasons by Freemasons. This weekly podcast is hosted to explore the depths of the Masonic world. And if you're new to the program, feel free to visit our website at MasonicCentral.com, where you'll find the ability to send us an email at MasonicCentral@gmail.com. And for all those out there, if you send us an email, we read it on the air. We'll send you some goodies to say thank you. This show is representative of our contributions and the contributions of our guests and does not represent the opinion of any regular or irregular Masonic body or Grand Lodge. Also, Masonic Central does not have an agenda, nor is it a recruitment tool for any particular body of Freemasonry. So we cover a wide range of topics and have a lot to say, and we welcome you all here. For those looking for upcoming shows on our website, you will find our calendar, and you'll find out who we have coming up through the end of the year. So we have a lot of stuff coming up. How are you doing tonight, Dean?
I'm great. And you?
Are you enjoying the basement? Have you been relegated out of the basement yet?
I'm out now. I'm out of the basement.
Free reign of the house.
Yeah. It's great. I'm back in my home office now.
Excellent. I understand we have a letter this week. We have somebody who dropped us a note in our mailbag.
Yes, we have a letter that came in not too long ago from on Thursday from a brother, from out of Ohio, and I won't share his name just for confidentiality reasons, but I edited a little bit out of it. And did you want me to read some of it here, Greg?
Yeah, please. Before we get in the full swing of the show, I'd definitely like to hear what we're getting in there.
Okay, this comes again from a non-brother out of Ohio. First off, I'm not a Freemason. I'm writing to you because I have been attracted to Freemasonry for years and have contemplated petitioning a lodge, but have not done so for fear that I may join and find myself disappointed with what I find in lodge. I recall your previous guest and sometimes helper, Tom Acousti, and he's here listening, by the way, right now in the live audience, saying that he may join Masonry with thoughts of it being a... He had joined Masonry with thoughts of it being a gathering of men interested in philosophical topics and discussions of Masonic education, only to find himself disenchanted. I share that fear and note his experience as being less than encouraging. I have nothing against social activities like cookouts or charity work, such as volunteering at an event, but I do not feel that I need to join Masonry to do that. I am looking for like-minded men who are interested in exploring what makes Masonry unique and how it can enrich our lives in a deeper way. I have heard many times on your show how today's new members are more interested in the deeper aspects of Masonry, and I identify with that. I also, however, recognize that many lodges are not interested or equipped to fulfill this need, and I reasonably do not want to find myself frustrated after joining. And I'm just jumping down to another part of the letter here. How can I make sure that I choose a lodge that fits my interests? What steps should a prospective petitioner take to find a lodge that best suits their needs? So maybe we'll just stop there for a second before I hit down to the very bottom. But so the first question was, how can I make sure the lodge best fits my interests? Greg, what are your thoughts on that?
It's an interesting one. I know when I looked at the letter earlier this week and just kind of mulled it over for a little bit, it's interesting what he had to ask. It sounds like there's a definite interest there. In regards to the lodge, I would definitely recommend, if you're in a community with several lodges, to certainly visit them. There's nothing to look at what you have before you and certainly pay them a visit and see how they fit with you and how you fit with them. I think that's certainly a good observation. I know in my area we have probably upwards of 7 or 8 lodges just within a 10 or 15 mile radius. So it's certainly good to check it out. What was the other question there, Dean?
What steps should a prospective petitioner take to find a lodge that best suits their needs? And, you know, I personally, Greg, before you begin, I do have issues with this. I feel that is a weakness in the lodge is that the petitioner doesn't have a chance to interview the lodge they're joining, per se. And I think he makes a good point here because some brethren get candidates get put in with poor lodges and get that first impression and then leave. And I think that is a strong weakness in some areas of Freemasonry, and we should be able to, pick and choose what lodges best suit our needs to whatever our particular interests are. So,
Absolutely. Though, you know what, I would add to that though, and just say that it's certainly like anything, it's impossible to make a fair assessment on just one visit, and certainly with going back and exploring it and talking to him. You know, you can't get a fair assessment of anything until you've had a chance to take it for a test drive, I guess. You know, go and
That's
visit,
correct.
talk to people, and if it's something that you're interested in, definitely insert yourself into it. You know, I think a lot of folks come at this with the misperception that, you know, you come at it and it'll all just be handed to you, with no conception that you certainly have to contribute into it. That it takes two to tango, I guess, for lack of a better word.
So I'm just going to end this letter here because I think this is a great letter to read on here because it, you know, it talks about some of our concerns and gives us a chance to acknowledge them. But just to jump down to the bottom, how did both of you, Greg and Dean, choose the lodge you joined? It sounds like you have great ones, and I wonder whether you happened to get lucky, ensured that. Would be that way, or benefited from changes since you joined. I don't. I'm not going to comment on the lucky part, but
I think that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say. You know, I think you have to kind of take the good with the bad, and you know, it is all in what you put into it. So, like any experience, you know, the more you put yourself into it, and the more you become a part of it, certainly the better the experience is. So I would definitely say don't go at it with an expectation of it just being wonderful. It's wonderful when you make it wonderful.
I will add, though, that I'm not with my Mother Lodge now, and I will say that my Mother Lodge is good for many Masons, you know, and gives them a basket of goods that they work with, that they love. And, you know, and I really, you know, I go back to visit my Mother Lodge on occasion, but I myself have changed lodges to one that I thought would be better suited for my needs, and I think that, you know, that's important too sometimes, to take the bull by the horns, and when you get into something, if you're not given the basket of goods specifically to your liking, and you've tried to make the changes necessary. I mean, I went to I'm a past master, my Mother Lodge, and for various reasons I changed lodges, you know, and I really love my new lodge, and thanks, guys, out there, if you're listening. Thanks for listening. There, Greg.
I think just for the individual who sent us the letter, and I very much appreciate you sending it to us, I say definitely check it out. If it's something you're interested in, then certainly spend some time at it and get to know the folks that are there, just like they want to get to know you. I think that's the best way to go through the experience.
All right, Greg. I think this guy deserves some stickers.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you're listening, send us your email or your address, and I will send you an email and let you know that we read your letter on the air, and we'll send you out some goodies.
Alternatively as well, Greg, if he was looking for a lodge that suited his needs, perhaps if he sent a back to Masonic Central a request, you know, to get him in touch with somebody in Ohio, I'm sure we could actually probably help him out to find someone that knows the lodges around there and will be able to hook him up with what he's looking
absolutely.
For.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and it's something that I've done quite a lot of with some of the sites that I've been on. So, absolutely. So, if you're listening, definitely let us know where you're at, and we can see if we can make some introductions for you, let you know who's in the neighborhood. Not to tangent off too far, but I didn't want to leave our guest hanging out there. This week we have a very special guest. It's been in our series of very special guests these last few weeks. We have Brent Morris, who's actually on the line with us now. How you doing, Brent?
I'm doing fine, Greg.
Excellent. I guess I should say, as I've found everywhere on the web, worshipful brother S. Brent Morris, 33rd degree, Grand Cross. such a mouthful. You know, I fall back so often just in calling everybody brother. So how you doing, Brother Morris?
And Brother Morris is absolutely fine, Brother Greg.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Thanks for coming on our show. I know we had talked, it had been trying to schedule this and got a date, and I'm very glad you could make it on.
Well, this sounds like an exciting use of new technology, and I in my mind, as you guys were going on, I'm thinking this probably is what radio was like 75 or 80 years ago, where a couple of guys, you know, had a transmitter in their garage and did whatever they wanted. And, you know, who knows, in 10 or 20 years, they may look back at Masonic Central podcasts and say, wow, you know, these were the guys in their garage with the infant technology. And
that's helpful, by the way.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, go ahead, please.
You'll be part of a media conglomerate.
We'll be picked up and rolled into a network program.
Yeah, that's
right. It's an experience that Dean and I are learning something new about every week or so, it seems, as we come across one technological challenge after another.
I'm waiting for Susan's room to call right now. Just hold on a second. I think they're paging me.
Okay.
So without further ado, tell us, who is Brent Morris? We like to start our shows just with our guests sort of throwing us in the deep end of who they are, so we get to know you a little bit, and so our audience does. Who is Brent Morris that we're talking to tonight?
Well, I'm 58 years old. I have a PhD in mathematics, a master's in computer science. I spent 25 years working for the federal government as a mathematician. In 2000, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, immediate pension, health insurance for life, and a cash buyout. They said, would I consider retiring? And I thought for about 30 seconds, actually about 3 nanoseconds, and said, sure. I had been very active with the Southern Jurisdiction Supreme Council. I'd been the book review editor for the New Age magazine, which is now the Scottish Rite Journal. And while I was offered an immediate pension, it would not support me in the style to which I'd grown accustomed, so I still needed employment. I checked with the Supreme Council, and wouldn't you know it, I called just before the Grand Commander, Fred Kleinkenecht, was going to the Shriners Convention. So it was in July, or late June, early July. And he said, I'll talk to you when I get back from the Shriners Convention. Well, that was the convention at which they dropped the York Rite, Scottish Rite requirement for Shrine membership. Fred said, you know, I need a director of membership, and bang, there was my job. So I retired from the federal government on October 31st, started to work for the Supreme Council, I think it was November 6th. They wanted me to start on the first Monday of a pay period, and I worked as the director of membership development for 4 or 5 years, and then I became the editor of the Scottish Rite Journal. I still do a little teaching part-time at Johns Hopkins or George Washington University, but mostly I'm a full-time professional Mason.
That's quite a story. That actually sounds right place, right time, the phone call made.
Yeah, boy, was it ever. I'm just so fortunate and lucky. And the way I look at it, I spent the first 25 years in my professional career. I describe it as having prime rib and lobster every night for dinner. And now I'm on that part of my career where I'm having grilled cheese sandwiches and pizza. And it's a great change of pace and lots of fun.
Oh, I can believe it. It's definitely one thing with doing this podcast and with the core audience that we have every week at our live show, I can attest each of us have a passion for this. You know, this is a great thing. It sounds like a terrific opportunity. What did the Rite do prior to that? Did they not have a director of membership at that point, or were they
There was no director of membership.
Interesting, very interesting. And that's definitely something I want to get to. I'm curious, how did you originally become a Mason? How did you come into the fraternity?
Well, I was an undergraduate at Southern Methodist University. It was in my senior year. And I had belonged to a college fraternity, Delta Sigma Phi, and I had a very positive experience in the fraternity. And now, looking back from this distance, I realize not everyone has a positive experience in college fraternities, or in the Boy Scouts, or in Little League. Well, I had a great experience, and I had, for whatever reason, had become interested in fraternity ritual and history, and so I had started reading books on Freemasonry and all the other fraternal organizations I could find in the SMU library. And then January of, this would have been 71, one of my fraternity brothers made the offhand comment. He knew I was interested in Freemasonry. He said, you know, I'm going to join my uncle's lodge. I just turned 21. And I said, hey, Bill, wait till March. I turn 21 in March. I'll join with you. So he said, okay. So I went and met his uncle. He said, sure, I'd be happy to sign your petition. Turns out the mechanic I'd been using for years was master of the lodge. He said he would sign my petition. So I petitioned on my 21st birthday, got my first degree in June of 71, got my second degree in July, then I had a bit of a jam. Texas has a requirement, or they did at that time, and I assume they still have it, that a minimum of 28 days must elapse between degrees. Well, I was moving to Durham, North Carolina to start graduate school at Duke University, and I was leaving first week of August, and I wanted to get my degrees in Texas. So I petitioned for a dispensation, and the Grand Master said, sure, you can get it 2 weeks early, but you can't leave the state without passing your catechism. Well, I got my degree on Monday, was moving out of state on Friday, so the only option was, after I got my third degree, they called off labor. The lodge members went to have refreshments. I learned my catechism. They came back in 45 minutes later, and I passed my catechism and then went to Durham.
I have a brother in my lodge who learned it in a week. How did you learn it in a night?
Well, I was on top of my form. I had just graduated from college 2 weeks before. Whatever skills I was a pretty good memorizer. I'm still a pretty good memorizer. In fact, I had learned my Fellowcraft catechism in one lesson, one sitting with my coach, and I examined myself. I learned the questions and the answers. So I said, let's give it a try, and maybe it wasn't 45 minutes. I could be exaggerating. It might have been an hour and a half, but I just did it
in the course of the evening. That's incredible. That's incredible. I know probably most of us on the show 2-3 weeks tops. That's an interesting story. And so from that experience, then how did you find yourself into the Rite, or Scottish Rite, I should say?
Well, when I was in Durham, I was a graduate student, and I didn't have a hand to mouth existence. My wife at the time worked, and I was active in one of the lodges in Durham, and the York Rite was active in Durham. So a year or two after I moved to Durham, I joined chapter council and commandery. The nearest Scottish Rite body was over in Raleigh, and I wasn't going to be able to participate. So after I graduated from Duke with my PhD, I taught on the math faculty there for a year. And then I went over and took through the 14th degree in Raleigh, so that would have been 75. Then I moved up to Maryland, took a job with the government, and 5 years later finished the Scottish Rite degrees in 1980, and got my 32nd degree. It was just an issue that it was a 45-minute drive to get to the Valley in Baltimore, and I just didn't have time. So I found the time, and for me, the Scottish Rite offered, and I think this may be one of the organizational strengths of the Scottish Rite, it offers men so many different ways to participate. You can be on the stage crew, you can be in the prop room, you can carry a spear, you can mow the grass, and you can do that and get recognized for it. So I was able to participate in ways that fit my schedule and growing family. It clicked.
Very interesting. I know it's I've just been part of the Rite for a short time, just 4 years or so, and mm-hmm. and have found that same sort of thing. Our Rite here meets on Fridays, and just Fridays with two kids is terrible to try to make, frankly. But in having that same thing, just what you're talking about, an ability to participate, for the last few years I've been a cast member in the 27th degree. So it's you're absolutely right. There's plenty of opportunities for that. Did you find that right off the bat you were active frequently? Did you pick up?
Well, I had just finished my year as high priest of my chapter in Laurel, Maryland, when I joined the Scottish Rite. And to be blunt, I'd had a very unpleasant year as high priest. I was a rabble rouser. I know that some of your listeners may find this difficult to realize. I was looking for radical reforms. And when I became high priest, I said the chapter is going to meet four times a year, but the four meetings we have will be the best four meetings we can put on. So I increased attendance from an average of seven or eight to close to 15 or 20. But that was four meetings a year. And each meeting, I put my total effort into it. And I was my secretary used to greet me as I'd come into the chapter. He says, "Well, I'm glad you made it, Brent. You haven't killed the chapter yet, but you still have 6 months that you can bury us." So that was the general attitude from the old timers. They didn't care that men were coming to the meetings quarterly. They wanted meetings every month. So I was looking for another place for my efforts, and also at that point I had a young son. It was becoming monthly meetings were becoming more difficult. And one of the things I did in the Scottish Rite, they wanted to set up a fellowship program in special education for Maryland teachers, and I was on the faculty at Johns Hopkins at that time. So I just went over to the education department, and we set up a fellowship and started, sending out applications around the state. We were able to set up a program. And so I think I felt like I was making a significant contribution to the Scottish Rite, and I wasn't locked into that second Thursday of every month routine.
The frequency. It sounds just like you've had a slew of this, just being in the perfect spot for the opportunity of time. That's great. I would, just as a tangent maybe, tell us a little bit about the Southern jurisdiction. Dean and I constantly go back and forth in the differences between the two, given the Dean's in Canada and,
sure,
and certainly not a part of the Southern jurisdiction. Tell us a little bit about the Scottish Rite of the Southern jurisdiction.
Probably... The biggest difference between the Southern and the Northern Southern jurisdiction and Northern Masonic jurisdiction, NMJ and SJ, and I assume that what I'm going to say will also apply to Canada, is the way that the governance of the Rite has evolved. And in the Southern jurisdiction, we have a maximum of 33 active members of the Supreme Council at any one time. We've got 35 states and the District of Columbia plus several territories. So at any time we have a few men in probationary periods that we call them deputies, which of course in the Northern Masonic jurisdiction is the top dog in the state. In the Southern jurisdiction is someone who is serving at the will and pleasure of the Grand Commander. And in the Southern jurisdiction, the Sovereign Grand Inspector General, the man who is in charge of the state, is very much more like a Grand Master. He has total authority over the Scottish Rite in his state. All the officers of all the subordinate lodges serve at his will and pleasure, and so this is very much like Plato's philosopher king. In the Northern Masonic jurisdiction, because there were a merger of two independent supreme councils back in the 1860s, they have 67 members of their supreme council, I think is the number. They took two supreme councils of 33 each, merged them, and then added a grand commander as a tiebreaker. So you may have three or four or half a dozen active members in a large state like Pennsylvania or Ohio. And in the Northern Masonic jurisdiction, the valleys are much more autonomous than they are in the Southern jurisdiction. So you don't have the deputy of the state, while he is a powerful man, he doesn't have the Grand Master's powers that they have in the Southern jurisdiction. So that's probably, in my mind, the... one of the biggest differences. The rituals have evolved differently, but that's not that's not that big a deal. There is one other thing. Our magazine is a whole lot better.
Hey.
No bias there.
Yeah, absolutely no bias at all. And Alan Fools, if you're interested, I still love you.
That's something interesting, though. In the Southern Jurisdiction magazine, they actually have a component of it that is inclusive of the Northern Jurisdiction.
And they do the same for us.
That's a feature.
We started that 4 or 5 years ago, and each of us agreed to dedicate one of our pages to the other jurisdiction. Tell us what's going on, what's the news, and so we're very pleased to be able to share that information with each other.
From that perspective, I'm curious, do you see much cross-collateralization, perhaps even from like the border states, from northern to southern? Do you see a lot of back-and-forth interaction, or because the rituals are different enough that there's an isolation between the two?
There's a modest amount of back and forth. You get down to Cincinnati and Louisville. I mean, you can just look at all the border states. It's Illinois north and east is the Northern Masonic jurisdiction. And you will find exchanges going on back and forth. From time to time, we've had the Northern jurisdiction bodies either out of Pennsylvania or Delaware come to Baltimore, and we'll have a reunion. And our Sovereign Grand Inspector General will give a dispensation, and we will get one of the NMJ degrees rather than one of our degrees. And it goes back and forth. Not as much as I'd like to see. I'd like to see, great, waves going back and forth, because that type of interaction, builds brotherhood and fraternity.
Absolutely. I would agree. I'm curious, with the same question in mind, and so from the Southern and the Northern, how do you see the Scottish Rite interacting with the other American Rites, the York Rite or the Shrine, which isn't really right, but how do you see the Scottish Rite interacting with those bodies?
Well, we view them as brother organizations. I know when I was director of membership, I was always invited down to the Shrine Membership Conference. We did some. We were looking at ways to reinstate members, and one of the things I found in my studies is that almost anything you do to reinstate a member who's been suspended in NPD, will have a 33% success rate. Call them on the phone, send them a letter, touch them, that human one-on-one contact. And so as I was developing my results, I was on the phone with the Shriners, filling them in. I was talking to the Knights Templar headquarters. It's more difficult with the Royal Arch to disseminate information, since they don't have the same strong central organization that the Knights Templar have.
It's interesting that you mentioned the factor of reaching out and communicating with folks like that and the success rate in it. I know just in some of the things in the local side doing that here within Lodge with the past members, that tends to be the best. And I wonder if, as a Scottish Rite, do you find that also in the sense of the Orients and Valleys and reaching out to the memberships?
Absolutely. I mean, here's what we've tried. I mean, we've tried a whole series of programs. Valley of San Diego, California had a program where they simply reinstated everyone who'd been suspended in the last 3 years. And we duplicated that program, and the way we set it up, Supreme Council will not charge per capita. The local valley doesn't charge dues, and so the first year of reinstatement is free. And the letter went out and it said, Dear Brother Stewart, it's in reviewing our records, we note that you were suspended for non-payment of dues. And I'm embarrassed to say that there's no indication that we contacted you to see if you had a personal situation. The only way we can make this up to you is to reinstate you to membership this year, which enclosed is your dues card. Your ladies' night's going to be in February. The family picnic is in July. And if you choose to pay your dues, come October, that's great. And if not, then we understand. Well, we had like a 30% success rate. We sent out a letter just before they were about another experiment. We sent out a letter just before they were about to be suspended. As Dear Brother Stewart, it's with great regret that I must begin the process of removing your name from our membership rolls. You didn't pay your dues last year. You haven't paid them yet, and our statutes require this. If you have a problem that we know about, please call this number immediately. If you'd like to pay your dues and get caught up, here's a toll-free number. If you'd like to pay it by credit card, here's a toll-free number. We want you to be a member, but you have to take an action. We had about 30% response rate. We tried in some valleys calling everybody that was going NPD. We had a 30% response rate. I don't know whether you can tell from the way I'm describing this that I've taught statistics for a few semesters in college. But this was cool. Here I am. It's not a theoretical problem. It's a real issue. And what was happening is the members just felt like no one cared about them.
That by and large for most of the difficulties and challenge that we face, I think that's what it comes down to, and I think definitely reaching out to him. I have to say, I'm interested in the success rate, the number. Your first number you said was obviously 33rd. This seems to be a little bit of a corollary there.
Well, you know, I don't. That would be getting a little too mystical for my taste. But we found the thing that was amazing is that almost anything we did, about one third of the guys would re-up. And I've talked to friends that are salesmen, and I've said, hey, how would you like me to give you a contact list that'll result in 33% sales? And boy, their eyes got big.
Oh, they're on that. Absolutely. Now, you mentioned it just a moment ago with the 33 that run the southern jurisdiction, or that are the deputies for it. I'm curious, is that how, I guess for lack of a better question, is that how the southern jurisdiction operates? That it's a, for lack of a better word, a confederation of these different states that get together and set policy or set plans for the coming year?
Well, I think it's a stronger than a confederation, because there's, I mean, it's the 33 active members are the board of directors, and it's the board of directors for the Supreme Council, and then each SGIG operates his orient, the way he thinks is appropriate, and there's not that much variation from orient to orient.
I can imagine. Now, with the Scottish Rite, would you say that today it's much different than when it originated? Has it changed much?
Well, perhaps the single greatest change is communication. Even 75 years ago, let's not even go back to 1801. Let's go back to the 20s. Telephone was just going in, but. But an SGIG out in the state was pretty autonomous from headquarters, and within his state, his valleys were pretty autonomous from him, simply because of the distance to be covered. Think of California and someone traveling from Sacramento to San Diego.
Full-time job, absolutely.
Absolutely full-time job. So each valley had much greater autonomy. Now today, with instantaneous communication, there's much more uniformity. There's much less variation. I mean, there certainly is still variation, but that's probably the greatest single change that has occurred since 1801.
And this actually leads into my next question with our guest that we had last week with Bob Davis out of Guthrie, Oklahoma.
Sure.
In that conversation, we talked a little bit about the idea of the Scottish Rite being a college of Freemasonry. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about that. Do you see the fraternity of Scottish Rite Masonry as an extension beyond the degrees of the third, as in the idea of a college?
Yes, certainly. I mean, if you're interested in learning about Freemasonry and its symbolism, then the Scottish Rite is the place to go. If you're interested in participating in the degree work and in being involved in philanthropies, then you can find that anywhere. But I think that if you look, especially at the Southern jurisdiction, and look at the books we have published over the last 8 to 10 years, we have the Scottish Rite Research Society, which is a semi-autonomous group for people interested in Masonic research and publications. We have just published the Scottish Rite Ritual Guide and Monitor. Art DeHoyos wrote this. It's a 950-page book. You could use it to hold down. Hold down a car during a hurricane. It's so heavy. Well, maybe not a hurricane.
I have to admit, I've been eyeballing it for a few months now.
Well, here's the secret. If you want to buy it, sign up for the Master Craftsman Program. The book by itself is $65. The Master Craftsman Program is $35, and you get the book with the Master Craftsman Program.
And that sounds like a deal to me.
It is. And the Master Craftsman Program is a mail order.
I'm trying to be quiet and listen and watch everyone here. But where do I sign up for this 35 versus 65 deal again?
Here's what you want to do: go to ScottishRite.org.
Yeah.
That is the web page for the Southern jurisdiction. And what you want to do, I think that's on our online store, which is in the upper left hand. We have a banner across the top, and then a column on the left-hand side. In the upper left-hand corner in the column says Online Gift Store. Click there. That'll switch you to our gift store, and then I don't know which one it's under, but that's where you sign up for the Master Craftsman Program. And
excellent. It's actually there's a banner there talking about it right below the main limited time closeout sale. There's a limited time closeout too, so you might want to. But it's right right below that. That's very easily to find.
Great.
We'll put up a link at our website to it. That way, anybody who's listening can get to it. With the program, can anybody in North America take?
Anybody in North America can sign up. It's six lessons, each with 20 questions. And basically, what it does is it guides you through reading the book and forces you to read the book to answer the questions. You know, some people.
God
some people
forbid
are
we
just,
have to read the book.
Well, yeah, the book looks so pretty on your bookshelf. Why would you want to, you know, get the pages smudged with your fingers?
So, maybe I can ask another question that's been looming on my brain here, gentlemen.
Sure.
Recently, there's been I've been reading about this geocaching society. Are you involved with that, Brent?
Yes.
Because I'm a geocacher.
I'm involved a little bit.
And we have a few listeners that are geocachers, and maybe just spend 2 minutes talking about that, just
cool.
A short little bit.
Geocaching is, I'm probably going to simplify this to the point that someone will yell at me. Imagine taking a Tupperware container, putting a log in there, and some type of a gift, maybe your grandmaster's lapel pin for the year, and you go hide it in the woods, and then you write down its coordinates from a GPS satellite. And then you go online and you say, I've hidden a cache in such and such a location. And then people will go hunt for it. And when they find it, they'll open it up, sign the logbook, Dean was here. And then you'll pick up one of the gifts. You might leave a gift yourself. And then you go to the next one. And we have just created our new director, our current director of membership development, Dean Albin, has created a Masonic Geocaching Society. And one of his goals, and I think is just such a clever way to promote Freemasonry, is to have, at the very least, at every Scottish Rite temple in the United States, a cache hidden somewhere in the grounds. And then try to extend that to get a cache hidden at every Masonic lodge. So now you're going to have people that are going to want to try to go to every Masonic lodge or as many Masonic lodges as they can in whatever their home state is, and sign in that they were there.
I will say that I think this is a great way to expand Masonry into some other areas, and I'm a geocacher myself and have a great time with my family doing that. Didn't get out as much this summer as last summer, but it's a phenomenal activity to do with your family. So
Now, summer in Canada, that's what, July 15th to August 1st?
Oh, settle down.
It's only snow flurries then.
Boys, I have not seen snow here yet, and you guys have been having snowstorms already where you are, so that just gives you an idea.
the idea of the geocaching is actually very interesting. I'm curious how much of that came out of it, because I know that the Scottish Rite had a lot of interaction with the promotions for the National Treasure too. Was this sort of an extension of that, seeing the interest of that and trying to
yes,
extend
I mean,
that?
Our current director of membership development, Dean Albin, is just an amazingly clever man, and he is out there looking for every way he can make Freemasonry more visible, more noticeable, and he stumbled across geocaching, discovered these guys are rabidly passionate. It really sounds like a cool thing to do. And weekend before last, we had about 300 geocachers at the House of the Temple. One of them from 11 different states. One drove in from Pittsburgh. That's like a five-hour drive. He got up for a 10 o'clock meeting and drove in. We gave him a tour of the building. We had tokens that we gave for numbered tokens that they were able to use as the gifts that they give, and a great time was had by all.
Greg, I don't do this online very often, but can you get Dean Albin's contact info from Brent after the show so we can get him on?
I sure will. You must be reading my mind. I actually just made a note of them right here. Well, that's actually very interesting. And I did just read it in the journal just recently. Actually, I left my copy of the journal at work where I was reading it last. But, you know, and that takes me to another point. You now are the editor. I guess, would it be fair to say the editor-in-chief of the broadest reach national magazine in the country?
Yes. Well, now, technically speaking, I am the managing editor, and the Grand Commander is the editor-in-chief.
Okay.
And yes, we have the – in fact, as far as we know, we have the largest circulation of any Masonic magazine in the world.
You know, and I was thinking – I can't remember where I read that, but I work in the publishing industry and work with magazines, some of which are some of the bigger automotive ones.
Right.
And it's, we're constantly looking at the circulation data, and then I had to stop and think about it, and then I realized, well, yeah, wait a minute, there's a million plus Masons of the country, so I'm sure that we have a tremendous circulation for it.
Our circulation in the southern jurisdiction is just over 250,000. I think we printed 259,000 with the last run. Now, we are losing membership, sadly, as all Masonic organizations are, but... You know, as of the last issue, I think it was 258, 259. Northern jurisdiction is, I think, more like 220. And then things drop down quite a bit. I think the Knight Templar is 100,000, 125,000. Royal Archmason, I think, is at 30 or 40,000, though, I mean, you'd need to check with their editors to get, a good count. But
sure.
Well, what I can tell you is a Scottish Rite Journal, to the best of my knowledge, is the largest circulation Masonic magazine in the world.
Brent, what's the cost to get advertising space for a nonprofit podcast to get mentioned in your magazine?
sounds to me like this would be a current interest item that we run every issue. And, if you can think of a good nonprofit podcast that would be of interest to Masons and can get me the story in 10 days, we can get it in the January, February issue.
Sorry, I'm laughing a little bit. Yeah, I think we can handle that. Greg, did you touch on his book yet? I know there's been some interest.
I haven't yet. Actually, I was coming to it. One other thing before we moved off of the journal, I actually wanted to ask, the journal originally was published under the name The New Age Journal.
That's correct.
That was well before you're inheriting the reins to it.
The name of that was changed... Oh, in 1995 or so, in the early 1990s. And what had happened, the phrase New Age was this very positive, forward-looking, I think we started publication in 1901, and we were looking forward to, just before World War I, the general mood was humanity can only move upward and improve itself, and things are going to get better. World War I changed that attitude quite a bit. So we called ourselves the New Age. Well, by the 1980s, New Age had an entirely different meaning. And there was we were the New Age magazine, and we had trademarked the name, and there was I think it was the New Age Journal that was out there. And you could go to Barnes & Noble and buy it, and they had lots of New Agey stuff, which, not surprising, given the name. And so people were confusing us. And we tried to assert our patent on the name, and basically we were told, hey, you can pound sand. We're going to call ourselves what we want. And that was the New Age movement. I don't think was something that we wanted to. It's something we didn't want to associate Freemasonry with. We didn't want the men in the street to associate, sleeping under a pyramid to increase your health, or crystallography or other stuff like that. And so go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it was the idea growing beyond where it was initially encapsulated, falling more into the aspect of material culture contributing to it. That's
yes.
Just my take from it. I know frequently in picking them up at my valley. Just flipping through them and reading them. But part of that, though, is that in some ways it seemed to me some of the older ones really sort of were the forerunners of that later New Age journal idea, the pyramids and the all the crystal aspects of it.
Well, over the years, the magazine and its editorial content has changed, and it depends on. In fact, one of the scariest things to me is I spent 25 years as a mathematician. And a mathematician knows when it's right or wrong. We don't deal in maybes, except probability. We can assign a real tight probability to it. For a magazine to work, it all depends on the good taste of the editor, and that's awfully scary because there is no formula for good taste.
Always subjective, and I can see how it's trying to reach that audience. Certainly, if that's not where they're going with it. I'm curious when the name changed, if you had ever heard, was there any disagreement with it, or had the interest in it with that name and where it was going in society, had there become a disconnect to it? Were people starting to
there was a disconnect.
Break away from it?
We were getting attacked by, Freemasonry was being attacked by fundamentalist Christians for all four fronts at this time. This was about the time of the Southern Baptist Convention foray against Freemasonry. And there wasn't a lot of thought that went into the attacks, but one of the things that troubled us was that by the name of our magazine, we were serving as a lightning rod for the entire fraternity. And,
there was
an
association.
Yeah, there was an association with astrology and, take the whole spectrum of New Agey stuff. Which had really nothing to do with Freemasonry, and so we decided that the name Scottish Rite Journal is very hard to misinterpret what our subject is. Now that was before I came on board, but I was the book review editor. I think I was the book review editor when the change occurred, and I said, the language changes. 75 years ago. Two guys could have gone out and had a gay time on the town, and no one would have thought anything about it. Today, if you go out and have a gay time with a buddy, it has an entirely different language meaning.
And, absolutely, different connotation.
Yeah. And it's neither better nor worse. It's just a commentary that language changes. And if you don't recognize that language changes, then you've got problems.
Very true. Very true. I'm just curious, and this is sort of a personal curiosity. Any chance that any of those old journals ever to be republished into a book format?
Probably not ever into a book format. I mean, they exist on microfilm, and so if you want to buy a microfilm, you can of the past volumes. And we have seriously thought about digitizing them and then doing OCR so that you're able to scan all of them. But we're into volume 105, 110, and so the question becomes, is that a good use of scarce resources? Are there other publications that would, better serve the fraternity?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a shame. You know, I look through them all the time whenever I'm in the library there at the Valley and just see them. And it's quite an expanse. I mean, it's 2-3 shelves going 12, 15 feet of just this accumulating journals that have a lot of great information in it. And it is antiquated and dated, but certainly always fun to read.
Oh, it is, and what I find interesting is looking at. There have been various times. I think after World War II, there was a tremendous push on Americanism, to the point patriotism that almost squeezed everything else out. You can go back to the very early days, and they were publishing fiction, short stories. They were trying to make this a very broad appeal. What I've done with the journal is I am focusing our efforts on Freemasonry, and this is my theory. And maybe 10 or 20 years after I step down, someone will go back and see if the theory was right. But I figure that the one thing you ought to be able to get from a Masonic magazine that you can't get anywhere else is Freemasonry. If I publish articles about health. If I publish uplifting, little sermonettes, if I publish patriotic essays, all of these things are fine, but you can find them everywhere else. The one thing that's unique to the Scottish Rite Journal is Freemasonry. And so I've decided that, that while I haven't abandoned patriotism, I haven't abandoned, uplifting articles, the focus I want to be is on Freemasonry. You know, that one unique product that distinguishes us from every other publication.
Absolutely. I think that's probably very readable in it. I know that in looking at it, it does focus on the wide range of the fraternity. And just in looking at it, it seems like it's been successful. Have you had a lot of good feedback from it?
Pretty good feedback. I probably don't get more, and you were complaining about your readers not writing. I know that I have over 250,000 readers, and if I get 10 comments to the editor after an issue, that's a big issue.
Oh, you shouldn't have said that now. You've got to get a flood in there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what a nice change. I tell you the biggest comments that I had, we had an article in there about burials during the Civil War of Union forces, Union Masons burying Confederate Masons and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And the title was Towards a More Indecent, and was supposed to be Interment, and we had Internment. And so you put someone in jail when you intern them. You put them in the ground when you inter them. You can't do a spell check on that word because it's a perfectly good word. So I had a lot of people point out that error to me.
Always the typos.
Yeah, always the typos. Hey, I'll mention one other thing that I'm doing in the journal, and your readers. I mean, I'd love for them to subscribe if they don't, but they can go online and read it. Mike Halloran of Kansas and I have worked to create a character, Brother Hiram A. Brother. Of Alapa Lodge in Kansas City. Now, we're not sure whether it's Kansas City, Missouri, or Kansas City, Kansas, but it's the Midwest. And he was born, I think, in the 1870s, and he became a Mason at a young age. And so what we are publishing are excerpts from his diary. And Mike is the literary genius, and I sort of throw ideas at him. But he is he's met Brother King C. Gillette. I'd had the opportunity to invest in the Gillette Safety Razor Company. Well, he thinks that's a foolish idea because who would want to throw their razor blade away? You just sharpen it; it's good as new, and you keep using it. And he's met Brother Rudyard Kipling was visiting Lodge one night, and was reading some of his poetry, and Brother opines that he's not a very good poet and didn't think he had much of a career ahead of him. And so Brother's an awfully nice guy, but he's basically dumb as dirt. And so we've been having a lot of fun putting him in situations. We were inspired by a column that was written in Freemasonry Today, Brother Lightfoot's journal. And this was a series of excerpts from a brother of the 17th century, I mean, of 1700s, late 1700s. And so our opening episode for the Brother Diaries is he finds out that he is a distant relative of the Lightfoots, in fact, the last living relative, and inherits all the Lightfoot estate, which includes his ancestors' diaries. And he reads his ancestors' diaries, and he's inspired to write his own diaries. And so there we have this whole sequence of episodes. He's met Buffalo Bill and Pawnee Bill, both of whom were Masons. And the thing that's fun about having him in the center of the country in the early 20th century is he has the opportunity to meet Harry Houdini, Ransom Owles, Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford, J.C. Penney, John Philip Sousa. And so we have grand plans for people that he's going to meet and interact with.
I know I've been following the artwork's great. We've actually talked to Mike way back, and when we first were thinking about trying to do this, we were talking to Mike, and he was telling us that he was busy as all get out, and now I guess we see why. They've been a lot of fun. For anybody who hasn't seen them, I definitely recommend checking them out. Any thoughts maybe to translate that into a almost like a serial comic? On the site?
I don't. Hold on one second. I'm not going to worry about that. This is my phone. I'm not familiar with is beeping at me. I'm not going to worry about it. Well, you know something that Mike would like to do, and I'm backing him 100%, is to see a book published of episodes of Brother Hiram A. Brother. And right now, in the episode coming up in the January-February issue, he's traveling to London, and it turns out that he goes to the pawn shop of Jabez Wilson. He's given mysteriously a pawn ticket on the street, and so if you're familiar with the Sherlock stories, Jabez Wilson was the man in the Red-Headed League. And so then when he redeems the pawn ticket, he got, and Jabez Wilson gives him a card and says, present this to Mr. Sherlock Holmes for a reward. And so that's where the episode stops. So Brother is going to have a run-in with Sherlock Holmes.
Very interesting.
You know, we might do a comic strip. Actually, I won't go into details, but I've been trying to get a comic strip put into the Scottish Rite Journal, because the active men in the Scottish Rite now are the baby boomers. World War II generation is just about faded out, and so it's members from 46 to 64 that are now entering the leadership roles in the Scottish Rite. And boy, I cut my teeth on comic books, and so I'd like to get a really first-class comic strip running in the journal.
That would be a great addition. That would be an excellent addition, actually. Something fun, kind of lighthearted. I look forward to seeing that. I'm curious. I know we're getting close to the hour here, and Dean's my clock watcher, so he's going to start jumping on me in here in a minute. But I wanted to make sure we got to a couple of last things. I wanted to talk really about your experience in writing the Complete Idiot's Guide.
Oh, okay.
How was that? Is that anything you'd ever do again?
Well, I think I was bleeding from my ears by the time I finished that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no! I was just chuckling at it. I can imagine just looking at the scope of the work that goes into a book like that.
Yeah, it was. I got the contract in May 2004, I believe it was. And Vinci Code movie came out in May of 2005, and the goal was to have my book come out 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the movie. And so my book came out May 1st, and I think the movie came out May 15th or something like that. Now, what I found out that's very interesting, when you go into Barnes & Nobles or Borders, they will have displays, book displays. Publishers reserve those spaces 6 months in advance. So that means that if you want to have a display in place on May, you have to reserve the end cap space by December 1st, which means they wanted to have the manuscript in hand on October 1st to give them a month to decide if it was okay. And now you back up. I didn't sign a contract with them till May, so I've got 5 months to write, I think it was a 350-page book. And now one of the ironies is I majored in mathematics because I didn't like to write term papers. So here I am writing the mother of all term papers. And the thing that helped me with the book is that as director of membership development, I had spent several years talking to people about Freemasonry. And I turned out, for better or worse, to be the guy that the press would talk to when they would call the Supreme Council. And so I had a pretty good feel for the type of questions that non-Masons wanted to know about the fraternity. And in my mind, I had, I thought had a pretty good grasp, you know, at the high level of the fraternity, how it evolved, what went on, and so on. And then I outlined the book and started hammering it out. And, you know, I'd get up in the morning at 5 o'clock, go to work, get home about 5 o'clock. I'd go straight to bed, sleep for an hour, get up. My wife would have dinner. I'd eat dinner. We'd chat a little bit. About 7 or 7:30, I'd get to work. I'd write till 10 or 11, and then go to bed and repeat the cycle. And then write all day Saturday and Sunday.
I can imagine it had been a process.
Yeah.
Every day, day in, day out. Actually, any plans on anything like that in the future? Any reapproach or anything like that for the Scottish Rite in particular?
In fact, Art De Hoyos and I just published the book Committed to the Flames. And Committed to the Flames. Are you guys still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, cool. Okay. I just heard it clicking on the line. I wasn't sure if we were disconnected. Committed to the Flames deals with a manuscript that was written in 1826 by a New York Freemason. And on the frontispiece, he said it was to be committed to the flames at his death. And it has the rituals of the rectified Scottish Rite, the earliest English translation of them that we're aware of, together with early Knight Templar and Scottish Rite degrees and other degrees. So, and this guy was a real interesting character, involved in three different Grand Lodges, six different Supreme Councils, expelled from Grand Lodge twice, he dies a Mason in good standing and gets a Masonic burial. And so Art and I have just published that book. The current book that we're working on is a translation and commentary on the first expose of High Degree Masonry, and that was a French book published in 1766, Les plus secrets mystères de la haute grade de la franc-maçonnerie de Valais. And I apologize for my French. Please excuse my French. It's the most secret mysteries of the high degrees of Freemasonry unveiled. Now, what's significant about this book is that while the rituals and the ceremonies that are exposed in the book are not necessarily the most widespread or the most popular in France, once the book is published, that becomes the template for all high degrees. Just like once Pritchard's Masonry Dissected is published, that becomes the template for the third degree, because there was no grand lecturer to teach the lectures to the local lodges. So by translating and Heridum, the Transactions of the Scottish Rite Research Society, has translated and published, I think, six of the seven degrees over its 15-year run. So we're by putting these under one cover with... And now, instead of translating one degree at a time, we're making sure that all the translations are uniform and consistent. You will be able to look at that and say, aha, now I know where Perignon comes from in the Elu of the Nine Degree. And you'll be able to look at it and say, aha, now I understand Darius and Zerubbabel in the 16th degree. So we're kind of excited about that. We hope that this will have the same effect on Masonic scholarship as early Masonic catechisms had when Knute, Jones, and Hammer published them back in 1950.
Interesting. And this was coming out. This is not out yet.
No.
You're working on process?
This is at least a year away from publication.
Very interesting. Maybe I'll pencil you in now to come back and talk about that one. Actually, that sounds very interesting. I know in our gallery we have one individual asking just briefly about your experience with a Quattro Coronati.
Sure. I am the worshipful master of Quattro Coronati until Thursday at about 5:30 p.m. Lodge opens at 5 o'clock. We read the minutes, pay the bills, and then I install my master. And I became a... I'm sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was...
I think it was in 91 that I presented a paper at Quattro Coronati Lodge in London. That's the... For those of your listeners that don't know, that was the first lodge of Masonic research in the world. Its membership is limited to 40 members of the lodge, and it has published a volume of papers every year since 1886. And so there are, I don't know, you were talking about, you know, how many feet you have on your bookshelf of the New Age magazine. There's a comparable amount of material for the Transactions of the Quattro Coronati Lodge. And we pride ourselves on scientific history that's well-researched, well-documented. We're not interested in the mysteries of Egypt and how they have evolved into Freemasonry. We want to look at something that's documented. So I present the paper, I think, in 91. I knew several members of the lodge already. They asked me, in fact, I remember sitting there at the dinner after the lodge meeting. I was at the head table, and John Webb, the secretary, was sitting next to me. He was sort of looking after me, and about halfway through the dinner, he leaned over and said, Brother Morris, I have a personal question to ask you. I said, well, of course. What is it? And he said, would you be offended if I proposed your name for membership in the Quattro Coronati Lodge? And I kind of said, no, not at all.
And so, no, me neither.
I became a member. I think it was in 92. I'd have to check for sure. I did a modest amount of traveling to Europe with my government job, and I was able to attend lodge, and I had some control over when I'd make my European trip. So I always tried to make a trip through England. If I were going to England, I'd try to make it around the time of a meeting. And so I was able to go to a meeting, you know, once every year or so. I submitted a couple of papers. I commented on papers. And then after I got to working for the Supreme Council, I had much more flexibility in my travel. And so I was put in the officer line 2001, 2002 or so. And last November, I became the worshipful master. And like I said, about 5:30 this coming Thursday in London, I will hand the gavel over to my successor.
When you fly over, can you wave to me? And can you pick up? They have some really good chocolate at a store like right in the square there. Could you pick me up some?
Where are we going to meet? You're going to come down to Washington to pick it up?
Well, you will fly over my city when you go over there, so you just drop it out the window, kind of do a D.B. Cooper.
Brent, we talked briefly about just in the early part today and talking about in prep for the call and how I mentioned how the hour goes quick, and we've capped our hour. We're on borrowed time now with our application. I wanted to hit one last question and just ask just what your thoughts are on Freemasonry today and how you see it projecting into the future.
Well,
go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, I know that's a wide open question that we could probably do a whole another hour on, but really just in your sort of encapsulating thoughts.
I'm an optimist. I see Freemasonry having tremendous potential. It fundamentally remains a group of local guys that enjoy each other and enjoy getting together. And I think the thing that I see is very positive is when I was a child, I can still remember segregated water fountains, going into a grocery store and having segregated water fountains. And I'm very pleased that in the most natural part of most natural possible way, that problem has been overcome in my lodge. Certainly, it's happening slowly across the United States, but positive change is occurring. We're seeing in the Southern jurisdiction and in Grand Lodge of Maryland increasing membership. More and more men are applying for membership, and so I am hopeful and positive that this will be the beginning of change. I think that we may see some of the side orders may just fail because there's not enough critical mass there. But I think that Freemasonry itself is, you know, moving in the right direction, in a positive direction.
Very nice. Very nice. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's my quick summary for you.
Excellent. Excellent. Brother Brent, thank you for coming on.
Brother Brent, this has been a pleasure.
We won't leave yet, Brent, because the best of the show is yet to come. And here's our pitch, is that for those that listen live, we do have like a little talk after the show. You can stay as long as you want.
Cool.
We open up the air and we let people talk. And I know there's some questions that we didn't get to in the show that some of the guys are looking to ask. And it also encourages people to come and participate in our show. So we allow that little extra feature. Greg, who do we have on coming up?
We have coming up, let me get back to our calendar real quick. Next week we have Timothy Hogan, who is the author of the book that is slowly opening up on my computer, The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual, which is very interesting for those who are into the alchemy and esoteric aspects of the secrets of Freemasonry that way. It actually should be a pretty good conversation. I read his book a few weeks ago, and definitely some good points to get into. And then after that, we have coming up on the 23rd of this month, Chris Hodapp, who we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff. And then later at the end of the month...
So we go from idiots to dummies, right?
That's right.
Exactly. And then we have Pip Fox, who's coming on with us from England on the 30th to talk about her the new book, The Masonic Magician, which she is a co-author with...
Bob Cooper.
Of course, Bob Cooper. There you go. Grand Lodge Scotland, correct?
Greg, and I must say, you did a lot of work to line them up, and while I've been kind of incapacitated, and I really do appreciate you doing all that work for us here at Masonic Central, Greg.
Absolutely, my pleasure. This is only the beginning. We have 2009 and a lot of good things coming up. And for those, and I keep mentioning this to everybody, but coming up in December, everybody who listens, don't forget, we're going to try to do an online table lodge for the show. So,
cool.
Hour and a half long program. Who knows what's going to happen, but we'll have some fun toasting each other doing it. So, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. Stick around.
I'll do it.
Where everybody lets their hair down, and we have our parking lot conversations. And this is a lot of fun. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Dean.
A great pleasure. You ready, Dean?
I'm ready. Are you?
I'm ready. Everybody who's listening, check us out at MasonicCentral.com. Check out our calendar. Send us an email. We'll read it on the air. We love getting your correspondence. All right. This is Greg Stewart and
Dean Kennedy saying
travel light.
Light.